Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, I cover the week ending 24th of September, 1922. Now, the big story this week, as indeed, well, it's the ramifications of what happened last week, which was when the Turks took Smyrna and burned the place to the ground and chucked out all the Greeks. And the Allies and the British are a bit worried about what's going to happen to what's known as the neutral zone, which is the area around the Straits, as they're known, the Bosphorus and the Sea of Marmara, which were occupied by the Allies at the end of the First World War. This is what... This is the report from the 18th of September, the Monday. An important statement of British policy in regard to the situation which has arisen out of the Turkish victory was issued on Saturday. It declares that Great Britain is prepared to do her part in maintaining the freedom of the Straits and the existence of the neutral zones. To this end, the British government has decided to reinforce the troops under the command of Sir Charles Harrington and has given orders to the Mediterranean fleet to oppose by every means any infraction of these zones or any attempt on the part of the Turks to cross to the European shore. The powers with whom Great Britain has been acting have been notified in this sense. The Allied powers in the Balkans are also invited to take part in the defence of the zones. Also, the Dominions have been invited to send contingents. The British semi-official statement was the chief topic of interest in diplomatic and political circles in London yesterday. It transpired that the statement emanated from No. 10 Downing Street, apparently without the previous assent of the Foreign Office. Oh yeah. In many quarters, the threatening tone of the statement was regretted, as were also its ambiguities. Yeah, well, I'm not surprised, given that No. 10 has acted without consulting the foreign minister, which seems extraordinary. But that's the stage we have got to. Just one little biographical thing, is that Sir Charles Harrington made his name in the First World War on the Western Front. He was the, if I remember correctly, the chief of staff to the Second Army, which was by far the most successful of the British armies up until 1918. And it's often been said that he was a large part of its success. Not that this is particularly relevant in this case. Anyway, the Times editorial has a lot to say about Britain's and indeed the Prime Minister David Lloyd George's actions here. This is what it says. This is also from Monday. That statement doubtless reflects the views and the methods of Downing Street as distinguished from those of the Foreign Office. Neither the somewhat provocative mode of expressing those views, nor the method of issuing such a statement before an official reply has been made to the last French communication, is to be commended. It is impossible to conduct foreign policy with dignity or even with safety unless the susceptibilities of other governments are respected. Is that statement provocative? I must admit, if provocative it be, well, it's sort of lost on me, but oh, that rhymes. Oh well, we'll stick with it and see what happens. You know what else can't be conducted with dignity or safety? London estate management. This is from Yates and Yates of Hanover Square. Sir, as the managing agents of a large London estate adjoining Regent's Park, we wish to bring before the attention of the public the dilapidated condition of the dwellings of the working classes on the estate, and to point out also that the Rent Restriction Act is the barrier to our remedying this very serious evil. Working classes in Regent's Park. That's really... I suppose maybe today there might be some council estates near there, but that is the only way a member of the working class is going to live within, well, anywhere near Regent's Park. Let's put it like that. Anyway, they go on. The estate embraces property absolutely worn out. Eh? What? Worn out? Anyway, we'll come to that. I mean, these days you don't get worn out property. You just renovate it. Anyway, they go on. And it is unfair to expect the landlord to go on doing repairs, which can only be of a temporary nature, and yet in many cases have cost more than he can get in the way of rent for the next 10 years. it was the intention before the war to pull down this very dilapidated property and to build flats for the occupation of the working classes. And we are prepared to do this now, thereby creating a great deal of employment. But under the Act, this cannot be carried out. Obviously, there must be some sort of clause which means you can't tear things down while there are sitting tenants. Anyway, he goes on. In most cases, the properties should be closed against human habitation. But at present, three or more families are living in one house, and we have no remedy against tenants who sublet their rooms. Thanks to the heavy fall in prices, it is possible to build today blocks of flats at rentals from £1 to £2 per week. Not quite sure what he means there. And by the way, I would say £2 a week certainly is a lot of money by most people's standards. In fact, I think that would be the average wage in most cases, if I remember correctly. And then he goes on to say, and for buildings at lower rentals than these, obviously, the state must continue to subsidise any landlords who wish to provide better dwellings for the tenants. Obviously, the state is getting involved in some way at this stage. I'm not quite sure how. A bit further on, they say, the Rent Restriction Act might have been desirable for a short period after the war, but it has now become the means of preventing the proper development of London, with the concomitant benefits of providing employment and of materially improving the standard of living. In case of old, worn-out property, the landlord should always have the right to get possession when he undertakes to pull down the existing dwellings so that he cannot be accused of getting possession in order to extort bigger rentals. Well, it's an extraordinary difference in the attitude, shall we say. I mean, these days you can't pull down anything. You cannot pull down any residential property. I mean, it just goes on forever, it seems to me, with very few exceptions. Certainly when I was young, a lot of old terraced housing was being demolished to make way for blocks of flats and normally council-owned properties. But nowadays, it just doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen. Anyway, the government is doing a sterling job making life unpleasant for all concerned, even members of the legal profession. This is from Edward Appinger from the Temple. This day week, I was conducting a case in the Metropolitan Police Court, when I accidentally swung my eyeglass with great violence in my open eye, causing me the most intense agony. I left the court and at once went to a chemist in the Strand. I begged him to inject a few drops of cocaine into the eye as I could hardly bear the pain. While sympathising with me, he absolutely declined to do so, and advised me to consult an eye specialist at once. My appointments rendered this quite impossible. My eye had by this time completely closed. I called at four other chemists, to three of whom I was personally known. They all regretted their inability to relieve me of the exquisite pain I was suffering in view of the state of the law. A little bit of background here. Cocaine is now illegal. The trade in cocaine is now illegal. Before the war, you could do as this. I can't quite well figure out if this is a judge or a barrister. Anyway, some sort of lawyer. But before the war, you could act as he suggested or as he thought. You go to the chemist, you get some cocaine. You know, you relieve your pain. Obviously, that's no longer possible, although I'm a little bit surprised a lawyer connected with the Metropolitan Police Court does not know this. Anyway, he goes on. The result was that from 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. I suffered torments. I returned to my home some 75 miles away, Cliftonville, that's somewhere on the Kent coast, I believe, and at once saw my doctor. He immediately injected a few drops of a 4% solution of cocaine and I was instantly relieved. Well, that's a good advert for cocaine, certainly. He goes on. Is it not as well to keep level heads and make some provision for a case like this and not punish the whole community because a few mental degenerates have acquired this hateful habit? Well, you might think that, but to the best of my knowledge, nothing has changed. Still, the judge, or barrister, was only in physical pain. Imagine you are this guy. This is from Tuesday, the 19th of September, 1922. Windsor Train Mystery Solved. The mystery in connection with the discovery of a woman's hand, arm, shin and foot in a brown paper parcel at Windsor Station, reported in the Times yesterday, was cleared up yesterday afternoon. Mr. Cooper, a medical student residing at Egham, it would have to be Egham, Surrey, called with his advisor? What might that be? Maybe it's his tutor. We'll see. Actually, we won't see. Called with his advisor at Windsor Police Station and claimed the contents of the parcel. He satisfied Dr. Osborne, the police surgeon, and Chief Constable Carter that the limbs were merely anatomical specimens, and they were handed back to him. The Windsor coroner decided that an inquest was unnecessary. Glad to hear that. Anyway, that is enough for this week. I aim to have something for you next week, but I promise nothing.